Hey, welcome everybody. So in this week's interview, I talked to Chantel Ami Osman. She's an amazing editor, writer, podcaster, and more. I had so much fun talking to Chantel. She had amazing information for aspiring writers, and be on the lookout for another chat between us in the coming weeks because there was just too much great content for one interview. Last time on the interview series, I talked to Emma Desi, writer and podcaster. During that interview, she shared some awesome content for writers, so definitely check that out if you haven't already. Chantel's business mindset really reminded me of my interview with Bianca Murray, so if you liked that interview, you're really going to like this one. Also, if you liked this interview, be sure to sign up for our newsletter so you don't miss any new content. The link is in the show notes. Chantel is the editor of Agora Books. Agora focuses on socially and culturally unique crime fiction and horror from award-winning publisher Polis Books. She was named a Publishers Weekly Rising Star honoree in 2020. She's been a freelance editor for over 10 years. She's an instructor at the Virginia G. Piper Center for Creative Writing, Authors at Large, and Lit Reactor. She's the author of The Quick and Dirty Guides 2, which is a nonfiction series on writing that I recommend checking out. Chantel hosts Words of Prey podcast through the Pipeline Artist Network. And in this interview, we're going to talk about editing as a career, how to educate yourself as a writer, MFA programs, are they worth it, the surprising downfall of getting a big publishing deal, promoting books as a small publisher, and more. So let's get straight to it.
So let's dive right in. So I first want to say, I don't know how I found you on Twitter. I found your profile on Twitter, and I looked at your website because I'm always looking for interesting people to interview. And as we kind of talked, as we were getting started here, like I'm always interested in interviewing people who have like kind of an interesting route into a creative career and people who are doing interesting things here. And I remember being alarmed at how much you do. I mean, my first question is like, do you sleep?
Sometimes. and you know, it's funny. I'm glad you found me through Twitter because I actually got an email the other day, and I'm not joking. That was from somebody that I apparently met at a conference, slight spoiler alert, because he starts the email with, I don't know how I know you, but I just found a note in my pocket with your name on it. It's like, I don't know what you want, but this is a very random way to start.
Yes.
Apparently he had pitched me at a conference and made a note about sending me something at some point. But I was just like, yeah, so at least it was Twitter and not a random note that you'd found with my name.
Right. I mean, that sounds like one of the books you would be publishing.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. I'm like, please, I hope you're also not outside my apartment right now. but it's also funny that you say about the, how I got into this business, because one of the more frequent questions I get is like I'd like to be an editor. How did you get where you are? And I'm like, I couldn't tell you. Like, you can maybe try to recreate this, but it was such a strange set of coincidences, circumstances, and people that I met that it was just, you know, it's a very hard path to recreate. But yeah. I'm very lucky that I ended up where I am. And the one thing that all of my prior jobs, careers had in common is that at the end of the day, it comes down somehow to language and expression. And so everything always had that in common, and that words, you know, persuade and can change minds. And so that's where my passion has always been. And being an editor just is the apex of that for me.
Mm. Yeah, I really feel like, and I'm glad you kind of said it that way, because the way I think about, as I was kind of looking into your background and reading your website, it really feels like these are all different things that you're doing, but they all kind of make up a part of a whole, obviously, but like it's worth, I think, parsing out and thinking about and talking about some of these roles, because I feel like there's people listening right now who are, like you're saying, like, are asking themselves, well, how do I become an editor, right? You know, I know you do some freelance work. I know you work for Agora. Like, how do I get where you are? And I think you're right, having read your bio, like, very roundabout way to get there, like through
yes.
Hollywood and law school. But
yes, exactly.
But I think it's interesting, because I feel like, and you know, you mentioned this before we started recording, which was the pandemic has really created an environment for people to think about what they really want to do. And I feel like there's a lot of people looking to switch and change and make moves. And so I've been really interested in talking to people like you who have this kind of entrepreneur mindset within a creative career and how important that is. So like, can you talk a little bit about how you think about all the different things that you do?
Oh, goodness. Well, I guess the key is don't think too much about any one of them. And I have to say that it was a really nice way that you phrased that about people who are really pursuing their passions during pandemic. And I'll definitely shoot over a link to you because a friend of mine, Amina Akhtar, who's a writer, and her next book, Kismet, is coming out in summer of 2022. But she just did this amazing interview that talked about, you know, she really only started her writing career like after 40. And left. She worked in like high fashion and journalism, and left that very high pressure situation to really follow this. And it was one of the most inspirational articles I've seen in a long time. Oh, so great. I'd love to share that if like you have show notes or something.
Yes,
I think it might help people, you know, pursuing that journey. As far as how I think about other things, I mean, most of my time is divided between editing, whether it's for Agora, which is, you know, the day job, and one day is basically 24/7, but that's, you know, acquiring submissions, listening to pitches, editing, you know, figuring out marketing plans, getting the book in front of readers, coming up with the covers, that sort of thing. But it's wonderful and it's creative and it's finding things that I want to read and I think that other people, you know, should see, would love to see. That I couldn't wait to see on a shelf, and you know, hopefully other people will feel the same way. Freelance clients who I have, from brand new debut writers who just really need overall guidance, to clients that I've worked with, you know, bestsellers for, you know, near a decade. And that's a little bit different. But then of course the rest of my time is a lot of teaching. I teach for LIU Brooklyn MFA program and the Virginia Piper Center for Creative Writing, Authors at Large, a couple of other ones. But I do a lot of workshops that way, and also, you know, in the before times, and now virtually a lot of conferences. Lots of professions, and some of the ones that I had, involve a degree or education that you have to have. And fortunately or unfortunately, and I think both are true, being a writer, you don't necessarily have to have a degree in something. Being an agent, you definitely don't have to. Being an editor, you don't have to. And there are pluses and minuses to these situations. But as a result, it's the onus is on, particularly in this case, since we're talking to writers, hopefully, it's on the writer to educate themselves. And, you know, as a lawyer, I used to have to do continuing legal education every year to make sure that I was up on everything. And I kind of feel like there's an author responsibility to, if you have to keep a jar on your desk and throw your extra change in there so that you can attend a conference or, you know, buy a writing book or just buy a book, because I think that's how writers learn. And I think self-education in this business and industry on the whole is very important, even when it gets down to, I always say, if you had to, God forbid, go in and have, you know, a surgery, let's say it's minor, gallbladder or something, you would still look it up if you'd never heard of the surgery and kind of get an idea of what's going on there. And I think that a lot of writers, especially through impatience, they've written the end. And also because the industry itself and Hollywood was this to an nth degree, but there's a level of mystique and a golden gate that you can't, you know, you have to have a passcode to get through. And so people think that they can't learn the ins and outs of this business until they've been given that key. That does the writers themselves a disservice, because I think that you need a basic background in the business in order to really succeed at it, or at least just to give yourself the best foot forward. And so a lot of my teaching is in that vein, demystifying. And when I tell you that there really is not, once on the day-to-day, you know, we're dealing with paper shortages and shipping delays. And so there's very little mystique to this once you get down to the day-to-day of the publishing business.
So let me ask, because I was going to bring this up later, but I feel like it's the right time for it. I mean, I know you teach for LIU in their MFA program, and actually I remember in your podcast, one of your episodes, you talk about this, like, you go and you get a law degree or you get a PA degree and then you pass the test and then you are that thing, right? Like you are a lawyer, you are a PA, you are a doctor, whatever it is. And for writers, there really isn't that clear cut, like, oh, if only I could pass the test, I could become a writer. And so you teach publishing and media workshop, is that right, with LAU?
I do.
And why do you like to teach that course? Like, what do you think students are meant to get out of something like that?
I have kind of railed against MFA programs for a long time because, you know, and in a sense, I have to say this applies across the board to certain graduate degrees because I felt the same way before I say all MFA programs are bad. For example, when I went to law school and then I graduated, I did not know how to file a motion. Like, I knew how to base, you know, a vague constitutional law argument, but I didn't know once I wrote that where I would hand it in to file it to the court because the program taught you, they expected you to go into a big firm situation where you would have, you know, clerks and assistants and everything else who would do that sort of thing for you. But really, there was very little of that day to day. I didn't know, you know, like, can you please send me directions to the court? you know, and I kind of feel like, in a way, MFA programs kind of do the same thing because rightly so, they focus on the writing. They don't necessarily focus on writing as a career, especially as a logical career. There's kind of that I am going to write a literary novel, which will be grand and epic. And you don't think about anything past that step. And what I love about the program that I'm working with is that they don't necessarily do that. They also embrace genre and they embrace how to write as a career. A lot of my friends, for example, you know, write wonderful epic things, but also do, for example, a lot of tie-in work in order to pay the bills day to day until they have that big breakout hit or even just for fun. There are ways to pay the bills being a writer, as opposed to just, you know, waiting for that one thing to hit, but also talking about practical things like career trajectory, how to find an agent, what you need in an agent, the pros and cons. There are, you know, it's wonderful if you get a six-figure deal from a big five publisher, but there are also pitfalls that come along with that that I don't think people think about. Like, for example, you have to earn out that amount. So people sometimes don't even know what earn out means. Or, you know, basically they have to sell as much as that before they make any money on top of it. And if they don't earn out on their first book for a big five, the second book might not get any attention whatsoever. The publisher might not put any strength behind it. Whereas if with that first book, you might take a smaller deal or go with a smaller publisher, that weight isn't necessarily attached to that first book. And I'm not saying that one way is better. I'm never saying to turn down a six-figure deal. but there are things that you want to consider and you want to think about in weighing that career. And also just things about how publishing works, like how a book is acquired. Once a book is acquired by a publishing house, what happens internally? You know, realize that they have to sell it to their marketing department, things in the contract that you have to deal with, world rights, audio rights, you know, what you're giving up, what you're keeping, who and how many rounds you can expect of editing. You know, these sort of things are really not, like I said, mystical or magical, but there's something that really prepares you for that business. And I think you need a little bit, you don't need to know all of the ins and outs, but it's kind of one of those things where you don't know what you didn't know until something goes wrong. Right. And I think that there's like a basic knowledge that you can have. And that's why I really like this program that I'm working with, because they give you that too. And I think that's a really important step to success.
Yeah, certainly. And I've met with and talked to writers who have MFAs and they complain about the same thing that honestly I complained about with my English degree. I got an English degree and it felt very much like they were just expecting me to figure out. And because there's no clear through line for English majors, writers, kind of from this to like a 9-to-5 job, it felt very much like I fell into teaching just by accident.
Right.
As like that thing to do, right? Like you need your job. Like, you need something to pay the bills. And I love to hear that there's MFA programs that are recognizing that and making those changes.
Are more doing it too. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing it happen more across the board because, you know, I think it's wonderful. And the program that I work with, Authors at Large, which is weirdly how I ended up teaching for LIU, because a very good friend of mine who also runs that program, Sue Shi, we met when she was a writer in residence at the Virginia G. Piper Center. I immediately thought we would not get along. She was a very fancy, you know, very literary dean of multiple MFA programs. And here I am coming from a genre background. And I thought, this is not going to work. I could not have been happily more wrong. And we ended up starting to teach together when we teach at the Authors at Large programs, because she specializes in fiction. And I was doing genre. And we quickly came to realize that all of these things go hand in hand. Mm. And these separations, like, for example, I always teach students, you know, if their weakness is dialogue, if that's where the problem lies and they're not comfortable, you know, read a screenwriting book, take a screenwriting class. If your issue is with description, you know, read some poetry, take a poetry class. You know, these things just hone your skills. These are all tools in your toolbox. And telling a story in maybe a faster paced, more what people would consider to be a genre way can actually, you know, work well in a literary standpoint too. Mm. So, you know, we ended up combining our classes because there was just really, when you thought about it at the end of the day, so much overlap, and being a good writer is being a good writer.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. I actually was going to ask about Authors at Large. So do you want to share a little bit about what you do with them and what that looks like?
Well, sure. It's a wonderful program, and it's led by Sue Shi and Robin Hemley, who is actually the dean over at the LIU MFA program as well, or co-dean. And it's a writer's workshop program that every year, well, until the pandemic, would meet in various locations. They'd have Iceland, Hong Kong, Thailand. The last one was supposed to be in Laos, and that was actually canceled. But they would have various authors and instructors come and do fiction, nonfiction, memoir, poetry workshops that were very intensive, as well as one-on-ones that would be very immersive. And also, since they were, you know, away and in these various exotic locations, would also be culturally immersive as well. Mm. And it was just a really wonderful, and will be again, wonderful retreat. And they're doing some online classes too. It's really great because you have a small cohort. The classes are 5 to 10 people for each section. Mm. And so you can really get in depth in the work and have time to write and time to share. And each evening would be like a salon where people would share work and then discuss other things or discuss topics about writing. So it's really a wonderful program.
Oh, that sounds great. I feel like the longer I do these interviews and more I talk to writers, it's funny how many things are out there that for writers that I've never heard of that are great for education purposes. And it seems like that's really where your interests are, is educating writers so that they can be really effective both in their writing, but also in their, you know, their bank accounts.
That's true. Yeah. You know, a friend of mine, Will Lavender, who wrote several really good books. I always call them the Westing Game books for adults. Mm. And they're just wonderful. But he once did an event that I attended, and then I made him write this as a list. But it was like the habits that you could do to be a very successful writer. And he had gone the MFA route. And once he finished his degree, he realized he didn't know anything to write a book. And so how he always says that he got his real education was he went to a bookstore and he read the things that were, you know, the bestsellers, the things that didn't sell, like figured out what worked, what he liked, what didn't work. And I think that the number one thing that you can do as a writer is read and then write. There are so many wonderful programs, but I think that they're also secondary to just reading and writing. Like, you don't have to have a fancy degree and you don't have to take any of my classes. But I feel like there are certain ways where, you know, once you get to a point and you've got, you know, maybe your draft done or whatever it is, that you can up your score, so to speak. You know, I think of it, you know, like playing a role-playing game, and you just level up, you know, and there are certain things that you can do to level up.
Yeah, I think that's a great message. And I think it is that balancing act of, you know, there's a lot of free content out there, and some of it's good and some of it's not so good. And knowing, I think, when to spend money on something that's worth it and when to save your money on something that's not is a tricky, it's a tricky thing to know about. And I feel like people listen to things like this, like podcasts, and they, you know, they listen. And for me, you know, talking to you, I feel like you have the same mindset I do. And I think that a lot of people do at this time, which is, yeah, I want to write a book, but I also want to figure out how to write as a career. Like, how do I balance those things is difficult and tricky to do.
Yeah, but I think one of the keys is thinking of it as a career. Mm. So many people, I think, make the mistake of thinking of it as one book. You know, this is the book. Mm. And that's great. It could be an amazing book. And the fact that you finished a book is honestly success, whether or not anything else happens with it. Like, give yourself so many pats on the back. So many people don't do that. But it's really, if you want to be a writer or an author, your career is more than one book. And so you have to think and plan it out just like you would any other career that you'd be undertaking.
Okay, I want to pause here because I think this is such an interesting way of thinking about improving as a writer. That everything you learn is a way of gathering skills you can use later on. This idea of gamifying can be a fun way to expand your writing expertise without all the stress. So what can you do this week to level up your writing? Sometimes it takes a financial investment, and sometimes it's just your time. But find a way this week to invest in yourself and your writing. Level up. In the next part of this interview, we're going to talk about how Chantel came up with the idea for Agora Books, what she's looking for, and more. So let's get back to the interview.
No, that makes a lot of sense. So I want to shift gears a little bit because we've kind of touched on this a little bit, but I want to actually talk about your work with Agora and how you got started and what you do for them.
Long story. I'll try to make it short.
I feel like that's everything with every time I ask you a
everything
question.
Everything with like, me. Right? I'm so sorry. No, and I have so many soap boxes. Like, my apartment is just filled with crates. Agora is something that I've been passionate about for a long time. And I was very, very lucky to find somebody who believed in it as much as I did in our publisher, Jason Pinter, who runs Polis Books. So the core ethos for Agora arose out of thoughtfulness and also out of boredom. I, and so was Jason Pinter, the publisher. I was so tired of seeing the same books over and over and over. And I mean no offense to people who write these books. I mean more offense to the marketing departments who believe that readers just want to read the same book over and over and over and look for that. But, you know, it was kind of the like girl in the title books, you know, where it's like, did I really see what I saw, imagine what I saw, or is my husband gaslighting me? You know, that could apply to like, I don't know, 50,000 books out there. And I did not want to read another one of those. And I can think of all of these other tropes that are very popular. And they're all well written, and they're all interesting, and they're all worth being published. But I was tired of it because, especially in crime fiction, and now we've expanded to publish horror as well, but for basically the same reason, you know, crime fiction at its core kind of shines a light on issues of justice, of morals, of society, of disconnects in society and disparate voices in society and lawmakers and lawbreakers and how that, you know, appears and how you can frame that. I think that the fact that there were so few stories from particularly underrepresented voices, but just in general, that were not things that we'd seen before or weren't exploring the true human diaspora, was kind of a disservice to the genre. And horror does very much the same thing, except with more of an allegory behind it. It's not quite so overt. And so I knew there were these stories out there, and I just wanted to find them. And so fortunately did Jason. And so Agora was born. And, you know, we, like I said, we focus on crime fiction and horror, particularly with social or culturally unique viewpoints, but particularly from underrepresented voices.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's great. I talked with Amy Elizabeth Bishop from DGMB. She's a literary agent, and I kind of asked her the same question that I'm going to pose to you, but I want to give some context.
Now I'm nervous.
No, I don't know that there's an answer, and so maybe that takes a little of the pressure off. But so I like I mentioned before, I teach, and I was teaching in Harlem when The Hate U Give came out, and so I was teaching obviously students who do not look like me. And when the book came out, I remember our school, we bought copies for all of our students, and it was so interesting. And I think it was great for them because I think the books that we had were just terrible, and they didn't want to read them, and they just were. I mean, that's just kind of the nature, I think, of some school libraries for this reason, right? Like, diverse voices have been so underrepresented for so long. It's hard to keep a large stock of diverse voices. And my question was, because I feel like after that book came out and after the success of that book, I see a lot more of people asking for diverse voices. And I feel like I know where you lie on the spectrum, but it made me think, you know, are readers demanding diverse voices, and so the market is delivering? Or is the market actually just in and of itself recognizing that they need more diverse voices and therefore pushing out more content in the hopes of finding readers to consume diverse voices? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And I think that my answer is that you've posed a chicken or the egg question. Mm. And I think that it's hopefully... the answer is symbiotic. Mm. Like I do kind of think it's both. And just to briefly tell you, the first year that Agora hadn't launched yet, and we were doing, I think it was BEA at the Javits Center. And I had my first list that was debuting, and we had acquired a few for, because that was fall of 2019, and then we acquired for spring. And we had a librarian luncheon, and they ask us to pitch like one book from our spring line. And we chose Matthew Henson and The Ice Temple of Harlem, which is kind of a Indiana Jones, Doc Savage adventure set in Harlem, in you know, the roaring 20s, turn of the century era, with Matthew Henson, who is actually a real life person. He was potentially the first man, but definitely the first Black man to reach the Arctic Circle. Mm. And so he was this crazy adventurer. And so Gary Phillips, who is an amazing author and a good friend of mine, decided to reimagine him as this pulp hero, and it's absolutely perfect. So I pitched this to these librarians. Mm. And not to stereotype, but I have to say that the majority of these librarians were 70 plus, female, you know, the very stereotypical when you kind of imagine a librarian. Yeah. And not all librarians look like this, but this particular group did. And so I honestly did not know what to expect when I pitched this to them. Mm. And they came back with, "Oh my God, I've been waiting for a book like this. When is it out? When can I read it? Can you send it to me?"
That's awesome.
And and it made me so happy. And I realized, you know, if I needed it reinforced, that moment reinforced that it wasn't just me looking for these things. Mm. And it wasn't just the authors looking to publish. You know, there was this symbiosis of the books are out there and the readers are desperate for them. Mm. And so, you know, it worked really well. And kind of like you were saying with, you know, schools and everything, we even had, I feel so lucky for this. My first release was John Vircher's 3/5. That book eventually ended up being put on not only a college curriculum, but also was a high school one read. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but like states all the schools do, like they pick certain books to do a one read and all the schools read them. And then the author does a Zoom visit or whatever, or does Q&A with the students.
Oh, that's great.
And so the fact that that book with obvious racial issues was so quickly picked up for these various curricula.
Yeah.
Again, showed me that, you know, especially even younger people really wanted books like this. And of course, like you said, you know, you and I are not this demographic.
Right.
We were lucky enough to grow up with books and authors who looked like us, and not everybody was. And so people are eager to see these things, and they should be out there, and they're wonderful.
That's great. One thing I wanted to ask about, actually, because I've talked to a few authors, kind of take this back to Agora a little bit. I've had a few authors who have published with smaller presses, which I know Agora usually does like 4 to 6 titles a year. Am I right?
No, actually, you probably want to slightly more than double that.
Oh, really? Oh, great.
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, originally our purview was going to be about 6 a
okay.
year. And it just ended up that there are so many brilliant books out there that we really didn't stick to that very quickly.
Well, that's great.
That kind of got blown out of the water. We started in 2019, and you know, honestly, I should recount, but I think we're close to 30.
Oh, nice.
Probably over that if I count the unreleased titles. So. Okay.
The second part of my question, I can still ask, but that's great. I'm glad to hear that there's an expansion over there, and that you're finding more titles and publishing. But one of the things that came up when I talked to authors was that kind of like post-publication support is often not particularly strong. And in reading about Agora, it seems like there's a lot of support there for your authors even after publication. And I just was hoping you'd share a little bit about that and why you think that's so important.
Well, thank you, first of all. I think that industry-wise, I very much think that it's a fallacy that actually I think Hollywood created when publishing kind of adopted the Hollywood method in, I'm going to say, the mid to late 80s. And they kind of still haven't gotten away from that. And COVID, if it helped anything, it sort of helped this. Hollywood is focused on the opening weekend. And that's basically all that matters. And publishing kind of adopted that, where it's, you know, around release. And that's all that matters. And I think that underserves the authors, because the best books and the best series have a long tail. You know, it's not, they might, especially if it's a debut author, you know, unless you have big five money, where you can put it on billboards and buses and ads everywhere, or be picked by Oprah's book club or Reese's book club. It's really very hard to get a lot of traction for a book that nobody's ever read anything else by that author. So this is where word of mouth comes in. This is where booksellers come in. This is where librarians come in. They are wonderful resources, and really do set the market a lot more than people think they do. If you don't have that kind of money, which an independent publisher, you know, we've been very fortunate to have books in, you know, the New York Times and NPR and Entertainment Weekly, that's been, you know, a lot of work, but also a little bit of luck. But we don't have the money for these sort of advertisements or massive press tours. So it does, again, to say the word symbiotic, but the relationship between the publisher and the author for a smaller book has to be that way. A lot of it does depend on the author working with us and working themselves to develop especially now that it's really hard to get in-person or even virtual events. I've had a lot of my fall events actually cancel and move to spring, because people are, I'm hearing from bookstores that were wonderful during the pandemic and you know, pushing events and our authors, and they're saying, you know, people have Zoom fatigue. They're not attending our events. We're not getting any RSVPs, and there's still that hesitancy for the events that are happening in person.
Right.
So unfortunately, a lot of that does rely on social media and the author interacting in the only ways that they can with their readers and their fans. And I think that is invaluable, because we as a publisher can tout the book until the cows come home, but it's really not us that the reader wants to hear from. It's the author. So providing guidance on that and working together and doing that But yeah, I never really stop, at least for my titles, promoting a book, because they're always relevant. And right now, like I said, one of the good things to come out of all of this is, I want to say, some flexibility on that deadline, where before, you know, if the book was already out, there, a bookstore or a library or a review is not going to be scheduled anymore for it. And now I'm seeing things where it's like, oh, okay, that's fine. It was 6 months ago. You know, we don't care. We'll promote it because it's relevant to whatever we're doing. And I think that that's a wonderful thing, because I don't know how many books I have actually, as a reader myself, picked up like release week.
Right.
Right? It's generally something where, you know, somebody recommends it to you a few months down the road.
Exactly.
Or, you know, even on like the Amazon algorithms, and it's right. Like, if you liked this, you might like that. And it's rarely in that time period. So I really do try to find the ways to make sure that tail is long, but it really is, it is key. And I hate to put so much onus on the author. But I think that, especially in this time, that level of interactivity with the reader really does make a difference.
Yeah. And I feel like now with everything, with, you know, obviously technology being what it is, I feel like it is more important, and it's more, I don't know how to say this, but it feels like there's no excuse for an author. It's not like, oh, well, I didn't tour in your city, so we never got a chance to talk. It's more like, well, you're on Twitter, you're on Instagram, you're on like all these things. And it really is a lot easier to interact, and therefore feels like an author has less of an excuse to say no.
Well, and I have to say that on a couple of fronts, first of all, before all of this went down, and you would schedule tours, especially if you're dealing with a debut author, authors don't realize, because, you know, mentally you have that image, I'm an author, I'm going to go on tour. And if you don't go on tour, that means that something's going wrong, something, you know, the publisher isn't doing it right, or, you know, you're not really an author. And I get that that's always been part of that mystique that we were talking about.
Yeah.
But realize the number of times that a debut author shows up at a bookstore event that's been scheduled, and 1 to 5, if that, people show up, and right. that might translate, that 1 to 5 people might translate into 2 book sales. Realize that the money for that event, you know, getting them there and the hotel and whatever, has either come out of the publisher's or the author's pocket themselves, because most publishers don't pay for that sort of thing these days.
Yeah.
And so it really does not, you know, these in-person events, although fun and great, especially if you can schedule another author with them, that doesn't necessarily translate into success or sales. And another thing that's kind of, it's been great for Agora, these virtual events, because I have a lot of authors who are not in the US. I have authors in the UK, I have authors in India, in Spain, and most of the time those authors would not be booked for a panel or an event or a reading or anything. But now with virtual events, I get my author in India in front of book clubs. And, you know, so that's really been a positive, where, and I'm hoping that this sort of hybrid will go forward. And the same thing is true with like conferences where I take pitches. For example, I do Writer's Digest every year. I used to do Thriller Fest every year. But those things were wonderful virtually, because I would talk to authors in Africa, in Europe, in, you know, that coming to New York for a conference, because those were both in-person New York-based conferences before, was cost and time prohibitive. And so opening those things up to a virtual audience is just so amazing. And I'm hoping that these conferences continue to prioritize that reach and access.
Yeah, that's great. Something I hadn't even thought about is those conferences going virtual. It's just, it really does open a lot of doors for people who wouldn't normally have access. That's great.
Yeah.
My last question is, where can people go to find out more about you, or find out information about you?
Okay. Well, for Agora, you can go to our parent company at Polis Books. So www.polisbooks, and it's at Polis Books on Twitter. And for me, the one general hub for everything, you can find my coursework and everything through it, is my website, Chantelleme, so ChantelleAIMEE.com. Or on Twitter, I'm at Suspense Siren, SuspenseSiren.
Great. And I'll link all that stuff too, so that when you're listening to this, you go to the show notes, it'll be there for you. So thank you again. I really, really appreciate it. I had such a fun time talking with you, and thank you again for all your everything.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure.
All right, so that's it for this part of my interview with Chantel Ami Osman. As you can tell, she's a wealth of information. So if you haven't yet, be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you know when her next interview drops. And go to the show notes to connect with Chantel and see the links that she suggested you check out. Last but not least, be sure to sign up for the Writerly Lifestyle newsletter so you don't miss any new posts. The link is down there in the show notes. I'll see you soon.